squirt or water.
Your brew day has a set of steps, and you know what's coming on, and you just need to pay attention and execute everything properly. And it can be a bit of a zen state to be in the brewery and surround yourself with the smells and the sights of a brew. Mitch and I have both developed this supersonic hearing thing where you're always listening to what's going on in the brewery, because there's all these processes going on, pumps running, things like that. And it, oftentimes, if anything's going wrong, the first thing that you get is a slight little subtle change in sound. And, you know, you could be in the middle of a conversation with somebody, and then suddenly you just perk up. Oh, pump's running wrong. You know, it's the pump is cavitating. You'll run across the brewery, or there's a leak somewhere, or, you know, something like that.
Being fully present in the activity you're immersed in is a big part of the experience of DIY. Like anyone trying to master a skill, DIYers train themselves to have careful, single-minded focus. For some, the enjoyment of that centered state is what keeps them coming back to their work over and over again.
My favorite thing about beekeeping is how slow you have to do it. Especially in the city, everything I do has to be like fast, fast, fast. And when you get to the bees and you open up the hive, you just have to take a deep breath and be like, okay, now is slow time. Because you literally can't move fast. Like, you physically can't move fast with bees, else you will get the consequence of that. You'll get stung if you move around too quickly. And so they're like giving you little reminders to slow down and be patient is the other thing that they really teach you. That's what I like about when I go in the hives.
Regardless of the activity, each person I spoke with expressed a deep enjoyment of creative problem solving. They all seem to relish an intellectual challenge. For DIYers, it seems that the outcome is often less important than the process. Struggling to learn new skills is nourishing in itself, and the collaborative nature of the movement attracts people to it.
The activities that we do here, where we're constantly trying to figure out what can we tweak, what can we improve in all different areas based on stuff we're learning from our users, based on improvements in technology. I mean, that certainly makes it exciting to come to work every day and trying to figure out. It's like one giant puzzle that's always kind of moving, you know? Yeah.
People struggle all summer to really learn to identify all the different species of bees we have in Vancouver. And it's hard and it takes dedication, but I wouldn't have it any other way, because it's that struggle at the same time that makes you invested. Next time we have to go vote about whether to protect a park or whether this animal is worth saving or not, if you've done something that takes experiential investment, you're a lot more likely to really understand the intimacy of why that thing is valuable.
Pretty much in any situation where you're trying to solve a problem or come up with a new idea, collaboration far outcompetes any kind of individual, you know, brainstorming. As soon as you have a group of people, especially with a wide variety of skills, the projects that you come up with or the solutions you come up with really are game changers.
Whenever we run into a problem in the brewery, my first reaction is to call one of my competitors and ask for help. That's the first thing that we do. And there's breweries of all sizes, and there's brewers who are way more experienced than we are. Like Ian Hill, for example, at Strange Fellows. We'll call him up and say, Ian, you know, we're screwed. What do we do here? And Ian will come up with a suggestion, because whatever's happening, he's seen it before. I mean, there is some competition, but it's pretty friendly. And, you know, we're all kind of pulling for each other. We all drink each other's beer. So, you know, the better everybody else's beer is, the better for everybody.
It is the diverse makeup of this growing movement that makes it so successful. People's widespread interests and varied skill sets strengthen the culture, as does their willingness to share knowledge and collaborate with one another. From beekeepers to brewers to app developers, one thing is clear. A cultural shift has commenced that places self-guided learning and versatility at its center.
We're feeling, hopefully, less pressure to ask kids what they're going to be when they grow up and decide on one thing that they're going to do for every day of their adult lives. More so now, I think we're celebrating, being a jack of all trades or being a polymath. So for me, I have a degree in kinesiology from UBC. I grew up on a farm. I love to draw. I know how to brew beer. I love to cook. I am a lifeguard. And I also know how to use a wide range of tools. And I think it just means acknowledging and celebrating all of your wide range of skills that you might have and how it could contribute to any project that you work on or any endeavor that you might take on.
A craft brewing is, I don't know, it's just DIY gone professional. The DIY side is homebrewing, and that's always going to be the root and core of craft beer in this continent, is that it's where it started. It was people who were dissatisfied with the options that were available to them from these huge corporations and wanted to do something else and got together and created something with their own hands. Rather than sitting back and being a passive consumer, you can actually, sort of define your own reality and make it yourself. Brew the beer you want to see in the world.
Three words to describe DIY culture: be skills, community, empowerment.
Yeah, exhilarating, educating, and flavorful.
Instant, amazing, and gratifying.
I would actually say that it's do it with others instead of, do it yourself. D-I-W-O was actually kind of a phrase that I stumbled upon. And I just think that all these people weren't necessarily linked together in the same way before, but now they are, and it's just opened up whole new worlds.
On my journey from beehives to 3D printers, it became clear to me what's driving the DIY movement in this city and beyond. People everywhere desire to reconnect to the land, to strengthen their communities, and get involved in their local economies. They want to create, to share knowledge, and most importantly, to collaborate. At its core, the DIY movement is about empowering people to participate in the creation of a world they would like to live in. Who wouldn't want to be a part of that? Why not do it with others? A big thank you to all our guests who made this story possible. Oliver Nichols, our sound engineer, Suzuki and the Hover Droids for their original music, and my co-creator, Jareen LaBelle. This project was produced with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm Leslie Kenna. Thanks for listening.
This is Bird Note.
Can I get that just one more time, Michael?
Sure, John. This is Bird Note. And today, we're taking you behind the scenes. It takes a lot to bring you the rich sounds of birds yodeling, cooing, and screeching to you each day. It's a meticulous process of researching, writing, fact-checking, editing, recording, and sound design. That's all done by our in-house production team.
Let's try that line with a little more animation.
Bird Note is a non-profit organization, and this week we're asking for your help. Your donations at birdnote.org ensure that every word, every sound, every minute is as stunning as the next. Your donation helps Bird Note to employ our small but mighty team, in addition to an impressive list of freelance writers and scientists. And, of course, our star voice actors, like me, Michael Stein.
And me, Ariana Remmel. None of this would be possible without you. And every dollar counts. We just ask that you make a gift of any size today at birdnote.org to keep Bird Note soaring.
Please donate at birdnote.org. Thank you.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
really appreciate your generosity. Each year for a week, we host Fundrive, our annual fundraising campaign that boosts our budget and supports independent radio. Thank you for your support.
Guatemala, a Central American country that borders Mexico, was most recently in the news for finding a former president guilty of genocide.
By unanimous decision, the court declares that the accused José Efraín Ríos Montt is responsible as the author of the crime of genocide.
Even though the trial was restarted on a technicality, this is all part of the country's effort to overcome the effects of a devastating civil war that lasted 30 years. The conflict, which started in the 50s, was fought between leftist guerrillas and the army. The UN estimates that 25,000 people died, but other organizations say it could be as high as 40,000.
During a 36-year civil war, 45,000 students, political activists, and peasants were disappeared, and 200,000 Mayan Indians were killed in the countryside.
Nati Garcia is the daughter of a Guatemalan couple who fled the war. They arrived in Vancouver when she was 3 years old. Now 30, Nati is 5'5", dark-skinned, she's got brown eyes and a quick smile. Despite arriving at a very young age, Nati usually wears traditional Mayan clothing and identifies with the culture her family left behind. Nati's parents are Mayan, a group of indigenous people who live in Central America and parts of Mexico. They were heavily targeted by the military during the war. Like thousands of other Guatemalan refugees, Nati's family was forced to flee when their hometown became a battleground. According to Nati, when they arrived in Vancouver in the late 1980s, they didn't have many things to call their own.
We lived in a one or two bedroom place, our first home, and it was about five of us. So we all shared this one mattress. So there was a lot of tension sometimes, and people wanted their own space, but didn't get that, but we'd all have to sleep on one mattress. And I remember that. And everything was very old in the household. Everything was secondhand. It was gifted. It was from donations. And I remember our clothes never really fit us well enough.
Vancouver is nothing like the place her parents grew up in. Her family is from a region called Ixcan in the Guatemalan jungle. Even though her family didn't have many material possessions, Fabiana Morales, Nati's mom, has fond memories of the village she grew up in. Given its climate and location, it was a perfect place to grow crops. So despite being a poor area, Fabiana says they were never hungry. Violence spilled into Ixcan when Fabiana was 18 years old. The leftist guerrilla had been operating in the region for a while, but the real problem started when the discovery of natural resources got the army interested in occupying those lands. The army was brutal in its mission to control Ixcan. They used the scorched earth strategy, destroying everything in their path and killing everyone who they considered a threat to their control over the region. Fabiana, who only speaks Spanish and Mayan mom, told us about when the army made its way into her village.
The next day we saw it with our own eyes. We saw smoke. They were already burning the houses. They were burning everything in their way. So we left.
Fabiana and her family fled to the mountains. The lush vegetation provided many hiding spots, but the army was tirelessly tracking them down.
The army realized that some people were still alive. They started shooting everything that moved. We heard the shots being fired, and that was the day we decided we couldn't hide there anymore.
Ill-equipped for the journey through the treacherous Guatemalan jungle, some decided to stay behind.
My father said, "You go. I will stay here to die because I don't have little ones." So he stayed. He said, "I'm going to find a little corner here in the mountain." My parents lived on that mountain for 12 years.
Fabiana and her family spent 8 years as refugees in Mexico. When they arrived in Canada, other Guatemalan refugees became the only connection to the land they had left behind. Before we continue, we want to warn listeners that the next section contains a testimony that some people could find disturbing.
When I was 8 and 9 years old, we went to a friend's place in Surrey. We were really good friends with them at that time. My parents were good friends with them at that time. It was a celebration, a party. So we went to this person's place to be in that space again. And we had ended up staying that night at that friend's place because my parents weren't sober enough to go back home. And all the kids that were there with her had ended up being put in a room where we'd sleep all together. And we'd slept there a few times in the past. But this one night in particular, when I was really young, there was this one person that came in to that room when I was asleep. And I remember waking up feeling that it was a dream and it was really dark. And this young gentleman, this young person had kind of woken me up by pressing his arms like onto me, onto my body. And I remember opening my eyes and seeing this person looking at me. And I remember having this feeling of fear, this feeling of pain, this feeling of what is happening. And then this person had ended up doing these sexual kind of actions that I wasn't familiar with at that age. And I actually ended up closing my eyes really tightly and hoping that it would go away. And then ended up waking up my eyes, opening my eyes again. And it was daylight. And all the kids were awake. Somebody was making breakfast downstairs in the kitchen. And I remember thinking to myself that maybe it was a bad dream. Maybe it was something that I always felt that it was a bad dream.
Even though the experience had left her deeply disturbed, Nati decided not to tell anyone what had happened to her.
I didn't tell anybody because I felt I didn't understand it. I wasn't sure. I would never had that conversation with my parents about respecting your body, about if you ever feel anyone that does any harm to you in any way, or if you feel scared in any way in a moment, to let us know. I hadn't had those conversations with my parents or had built that trust enough with my parents.
That wasn't the only topic they didn't discuss, though. Nati's parents had never told their children about the hardships they faced during their exile. Nati's questions were always met with evasives or silence. When Fabiana arrived in Canada, the country felt like a totally foreign place to her. She didn't know anyone, so she stayed home a lot. Unable to grow her own food, Fabiana felt she couldn't connect to this new land. And without any professional help, she and her husband were having issues coping with their past.
My husband used to have a lot of problems. He was maybe 20 or 25 years old when the war started, and that kind of affected him. He used to feel a little bit of rage, and that made him start drinking. Sometimes at the house, he would be drunk, and all that rage he had, he would take it out on us. He would take it out on the family. Sometimes he would hurt the family, so the children started being afraid of him.
My parents' relationship was, I feel, was full of a lot of tensions. I remember listening and witnessing to some of the arguments that they would have and not understanding where it came from, but only feeling the emotions that came from it.
All the tension, sadness, and silence drew Nati away from home. Feeling disconnected to her own family, she befriended other teenagers from troubled homes. At age 12, she became sexually active, and then she started drinking and doing drugs. Her parents didn't know what she was up to. She barely spoke to them.
My relationship with my parents during my childhood was, there was a lot of anger. I did not communicate with them at all about anything. I hated them. Like, I just, especially my dad, I hated my dad. I felt that he had brought all of this pain to me. I felt it was because of his alcoholism. It was because of the violence that he brought into the household that it drove me to where I was as a teenager. And my mom, I hated my mom because I felt that she wasn't there for me.
Nati still hadn't come to terms with what had happened to her as a child. She frequently had a disturbing dream about a shadow sexually forcing itself into her. But she hadn't considered the possibility that the dreams were based on reality. Everything changed one day when she ran into a familiar figure while picking blueberries with her mom.
I remember in a far distance seeing this figure of a man talking to my mom and I guess talking to the other women, other family members there. And I remember just this feeling of fear just entering my body. I just became paralyzed. That paralyzation, similar to what had happened during that incident, I felt that again. And I was triggered by this figure and did not know what it was. And it wasn't until later, and I had like run into like the blueberry bushes and I had just hid there. I just stayed there. I didn't want to come out. And not until later on in the evening when that person had left and we had gone back home, I started to ponder on that question as to why I had felt that way. And I came to realize that this feeling really was connected to the dream that I had. And I didn't know fully then, but it was a start into opening that wound of understanding that this was not a dream. What had happened was real.
After realizing that she had been a victim of sexual assault, she confided it to her best friend, who encouraged her to deal with it. It was the first time Nati said what had happened to her out loud.
I cried a lot. It was the first time I had cried in front of anybody, and it was with her because I trusted her. She was the first person I really, really trusted, so she held that space for me to share my childhood.
Finally, being able to talk to someone about the experience proved helpful. But Nati still hadn't dealt with many of the underlying issues. She spent the next 10 years taking refuge in alcohol, drugs, and destructive relationships. By then, her parents had found a way to sober up by reconnecting with their indigenous roots. But Nati was convinced this strategy wouldn't work for her. Looking for a fresh start, she and her best friend moved to Montreal. But the new setting didn't change Nati's old habits. She continued to abuse drugs and alcohol. Her behavior eventually led to a fight with her friend. The fallout made Nati realize she had to fully confront what had happened to her as a child. So she went back home to tell her parents about it.
That conversation was very hard. It was one of the most challenging conversations I have had with my family. I remember all of us sitting kind of in like a circle. And I remember nobody had any idea why they were there, why this was being initiated by me. I told them that I hadn't told them because I didn't trust them. I didn't feel they would understand her. It was more of trust. I just didn't trust them, and I told them that. I had still hated them and had resentment towards them, so it was hard for me to share anything with them. So this was one of the first moments where I really shared something vulnerable to my parents.
Listening to Nati, Fabiana realized that keeping her children in the dark had created trust issues, so she decided to open up to them. After walking in the jungle for 8 days, Fabiana and her family finally made it to Mexico. But they soon realized they weren't alone. Thousands of people had fled to the neighboring country, where a makeshift refugee camp had been established near the border.
The United Nations had already arrived to help, but since we were thousands of people, we only got one or two tortillas a day. And that's not enough for a person. It's not enough to sustain a body. We didn't have any clothes. We didn't have cooking utensils. We had nothing. We went out looking for scraps, for anything we could use to boil some water. And that's when people started getting sick. One of my children died because he was struck by sickness.
The family was then sent to another refugee camp in the Mexican state of Campeche. They lived there for the next 8 years. It was here where Nati was born. The conditions were similar to the ones they had faced in the border.
The place they sent us to was dry. The water, well, they would only give us a liter per person per day. And that's not enough. The food was the same, it was rationed. So I would give my children all of it, even if I didn't eat anything.
Slowly, Fabiana lost hope. She started thinking that the family would have to stay in Campeche forever. But one day, out of the blue, they received a letter from Fabiana's brother-in-law. He had emigrated to Canada before the family fled to Mexico. He initially thought they had died during the conflict, but after discovering his family members were alive, he helped them resettle in Vancouver. It was then that Fabiana and her husband decided they would never discuss the details of their exile with their children.
I think that if my parents had been a bit more open to their own experience, it would have been a more safer space for me to be able to share my experience. Because I would have known that, wow, you've gone through so much. You can relate to my pain.
Nati's confession motivated her parents to finally share their experiences during the war. Understanding all the violence and trauma they endured for almost a decade has allowed her to put away her negative feelings towards them. She now embraces them for who they are. But Nati's commitment to break the silence goes well beyond her household. Now she's a social worker.
I'm very focused with youth and children because I realize the importance of the innocence, the importance of providing that nurturing space and empowering them as beautiful beings to see their true power and allow themselves to creatively explore it and connect with it.
Nati's family is still healing, but coping with decades of silence takes time and the help of every family member. Nati's parents don't drink anymore. The family has also found a place where they can grow traditional Guatemalan crops. Joining her parents at the farm has helped Nati reconnect with her indigenous roots. All of this makes Nati have high hopes for the future.
I'm still healing, so I see myself being a bit more liberated and free and working with a community, my community back home in Guatemala. And I see my family full of lots of love and joy, and I see them stronger. I see the roots of our household to be more grounded.
This documentary was produced by Carlos Tello and Aurora Tejeda with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. We would like to thank Nati and Fabiana for sharing their stories with us.
Trolling college music so you don't have to. No loyalties, no orthodoxy. Keeping it real, dumb, and organic since 2019. Tune into Home of Burnaby Rock with John on Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m.
Indie Fest is a fiercely modern celebration of innovative ideas in the performing arts and the indie artists who imagine them, showcasing genre-defying works, collaborations, and immersive experiences. This year's Indie Fest runs November 17th to the 26th and will empower artists and viewers alike towards a new, hopeful future. Explore more and buy tickets today at indiefest.eventbrite.ca.